Hi, this is Bruce McDonald, and welcome to Academics of PA. Today, I have the legendary and notorious Charles Goodsell with me. So, Dr. Goodsell, thank you for joining.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Dr. Goodsell. How are you doing today?
Doing fine. I've been watching the hearings.
I'm trying not to because they stress me out.
I can't go too long. But that's what I've been doing this morning, just now. Well, I'm ready to go. How would you like to proceed?
Well, one of the first things I want to ask is your background's actually kind of fairly interesting to me. And when I say background, I'm actually talking pre your academic professional career, but more thinking about your undergraduate and your military experience shortly after your undergraduate experience. I don't think a lot of people know, but your dad was a president at Kalamazoo College, and then you were a student there, if I recall correctly.
Well, no, my father was president many years before.
Okay.
Yeah, in 1936, he was acting president when the regular president was dying of cancer and passed away. I went to Kalamazoo College in 1950 after graduating from high school, and graduated in 54. And then, as you mentioned, I went into the Army and the Counterintelligence Corps, and had the good luck to be sent to Berlin, and I stayed there for a year and a half during the rest of my duty, and had a very interesting time. My main occupation was writing reports on the comments by refugees coming from East Germany or farther east into West Berlin. Before the wall was built, there was a tremendous stream of immigrants, immigrants coming through, refugees really is the word. And they would be interviewed by German interviewers, interrogators, and then I would have a rough outline of the subject matter in English, and then I put it into English that could be sent to the Pentagon, and I sent in hundreds of these things, and it was a great experience for me. For one thing, it helped me learn to write, because it had to be just right.
Yeah, I would imagine that's with writing that many reports, you get a lot of experience of writing a lot and writing quickly.
Yeah. And it had to be, the grammar had to be perfect and all the rest of it. And it had to be clear, too. But anyway, I've always enjoyed writing. And after I got my doctorate at Harvard, I got my first job in University of Puerto Rico. And as soon as I got a hold of my new classes down there, I started writing. And I haven't stopped since. And it's kind of a thing that I enjoy doing on its own. You wanted to know about my past experience before, how I got interested in public administration?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I was a political science major at Kalamazoo College, and we didn't even have a course in public administration. And I got my first job then I went to Puerto Rico to teach in a Master of Public Administration program. Escuela de Administración Pública, and I had to teach public administration courses, obviously, and I was allowed to do so in English, fortunately, because I had to learn Spanish from start, and that I guess lit my interest, and I started my first book after a year, and it was a study of the revolution that occurred during World War II, when Muñoz Marin, the great Puerto Rican political leader that was responsible for bringing modern Puerto Rico into existence, was associated with the last colonial governor of the island, Rexford Tugwell, the brain stressor. And he had come down from New York City, where he was doing planning work, and he was in retirement. And it hasn't happened. He moved in to a residence right across the street from me, and I got to know him. And And I went to the librarian in the university one time and said, look, I'm getting ready to try to think of a book to write on Puerto Rico. It's just as a natural act. And I looked at the colonial period and wondered if that would be appropriate. And he said, absolutely not, Dr. Goodsell. Don't try that. You won't be able to read the writing of the documents from the colonial period. They're in antiquated Spanish and handwritten and everything else. He said, however, there was a fascinating period between 1941 and 1946 when Tugwell was governor and Munoz Marin had just became the leader of the legislative branch here and governor. He was governor. He was to become the governor after the commercial Tugwell's term of office as a colonial governor was over. Then it was going to be turned over to the island and the governorship. And during that interim period there, this librarian said there was a wonderful relationship between these two men. One who was fascinated and totally involved in the politics of the giant takeover from the oligarchs in the legislature and then later the governorship, and this guy Tugwell, who was schooled in public administration in a natural way because he was in the New Deal and headed the resettlement administration and did all kinds of interesting things. And it was a partnership between the two of them that made it possible to have a revolutionary government, not in the sense of violence, but in terms of policy work, because Munoz would have these ideas and Tugwell would know the kinds of institutions that had to be created. And so I wrote this book on that subject and called it Administration of a Revolution. So that, you know, after I did all that, I was sold on the field of PA as a career field. And in my later teaching years at Southern Illinois, and here at Virginia Tech, that's what I emphasized, and I just fell in love with it as a, you know, ostensibly boring area of management to it, but if you scratch below the surface, a fascinating subject, both in political sense and organizational theory and institution building. So that's how I got interested in it. I've been stuck ever since, although I occasionally got bored with it. And in my middle years here at Tech, I got interested in the social and political implications of architecture and wrote two books on that subject and sort of got that out of my head and returned to public administration.
Well, if I can ask, if you really didn't kind of find the love for public administration until you're working on the book, why did you go to grad school or what drove you to do the PhD in the first place?
I went to Harvard for only one reason. My chairperson and main professor at Kalamazoo College said, Charles, you have to go to Harvard, period. You just can't go anywhere else. He said they have guys like Carl J. Friedrich there and others, and you simply have to go there. So I applied and was accepted, but then I couldn't. I decided I wanted to go somewhere else before going to graduate school, so I enlisted in the Army and went to Berlin, then came back and Harvard accepted my previous acceptance, and I got a fellowship from my own college. And so I spent 4.5 years in Cambridge, and they were tremendous years in terms of molding me and allowing me to grow and giving me opportunity. I'll tell you a secret. You can keep this in the tape if you want to. I, When I got there, the work seemed to be so overpoweringly hard and advanced and sophisticated that I thought, wow, I'm never going to make this. So my immediate goal became, I'm going to flunk out in dignity. But, you know, if I can flunk out in dignity, that's good enough. But as things went on, you know, I got confident and into the courses and making contacts and getting encouragement from the faculty and had a great time with it.
Now, you had V.O. Key as your dissertation chair, is that correct?
Arthur Moss, he's now gone, but I don't know if you knew him, he was he had kind of a edge to him, and a lot of the students were scared to death of him, and I was more or less overwhelmed too, but I liked him. and so he took me in and guided me through the dissertation, and I got my doctorate. I got my doctorate in the subject that's at the front of the agenda of American government here at this moment, and that is, it's on congressional access to executive information, which is the title. And I wrote a dissertation on that. And
so that makes
I never published it, though.
That makes the hearings going on today for the impeachment particularly interesting for you, then.
Yeah, you know, that's so much of the struggle is on that issue.
One thing that I'm kind of curious about is when you graduated, your first job, as you said, was in Puerto Rico, which going from Harvard to Puerto Rico is a little bit of a different trail for most academics today, and I imagine it was a fairly big shift back then. What was it about the job in Puerto Rico that kind of pulled you in to go there versus someplace else?
Yeah, it was the first regular job. I had had internships in Washington for three summers during my doctoral work at the Bureau of the Budget. And that's when I met my wife, my future wife. But you're right, it was a huge jump. I didn't have any other job offers. I finished mid-year the dissertation, and I didn't have any other offers and in front of me. And this man, and I got a call from the dean of the public administration school at Harvard, and he said, there's a man here from Puerto Rico that would like to interview somebody for a job. And so I went over there, and this man took me to a downtown Boston hotel and showed me all kinds of literature and so on, and convinced me that I would have an interesting experience going down there. And so I said, okay, I'll do it. And I talked to my wife. I said, I've got a job in Puerto Rico. She said, great. Let's go find a globe somewhere and find out where it is. So we jumped off the face of a cliff. You know, we had no idea what was going to happen. But it turned out to be a really wonderful experience of cross-cultural experience and learning Spanish. And I got very interested in Latin politics and public administration and the whole kind of culture and in that area. And I went back and wrote a book on Peru because of my interest in that had been aroused in Latin America. So it took a while to get that out of my system too, but I really fell in love with that area for a while.
What was it then that pulled you back to the U.S., particularly when you went to Illinois?
Well, I thought the island 100 miles long was too small a stage to have a career in. And I needed to come back to the States where the action is really in our field. And I got a temporary 1-2 year job at the Brookings Institution to help a man write a book. And meanwhile, I got this job offer at Southern Illinois. And the reason I got that was that Tugwell, after he left Puerto Rico, had a temporary period at the University of Southern Illinois in Carbondale. And they told him they were looking for another young professor, and he gave him my name. And so they called me, and you know, after a long time thinking about it, we went down there and stayed for 12 years. So a lot of my career has been by sheer luck and circumstance and jumping off cliffs and getting bored and trying something new.
I like that. I think there's a tendency of people now to kind of, you go to one school, you stay at the school, you spend your career studying one thing.
Yeah.
And I think I'm kind of more like you, where I like the idea of kind of being able to pick up and do something different, study something a little bit different right at different points in time as they interest me.
Well, that's been my hallmark all the way through all these years, Bruce. I get bored. If I've done a study of something and did my best, after I finish that, I'm not interested in doing that again. You know, I want to move on to some other area because I enjoy so much learning from the process of scholarship, personal learning.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing that I enjoyed.
Thinking back between the job in Puerto Rico, going to Illinois, being at the Brookings Institute, and then eventually making your way back to Virginia Tech, what do you think that you've kind of taken away from having all of those jumps in your path along the way?
Well, one thing I decided was that my deepest heart interest is PA, is public administration, and how governance actually works and the problems that it faces. And then on top of that, I about halfway through my period in Southern Illinois, I kept noticing here, I found that the at that time the orthodoxy of public administration was that it's oppressive, and that's where you get the idea you get from sociology, the sociology of bureaucracy. And B, it's inefficient, and that's what you get from the economics point of view. And so I noticed from time to time as I was teaching there, I'm running across articles which said something really good about what bureaucracy does and its effectiveness, even compared to the private sector, and it's the motivation of its employees is not just extrinsic, it's also intrinsic. And then it suddenly hit me that, by gosh, I ought to pull all of these threads of positive reports together. And I went to a meeting, a conference down in Tennessee one time, and I was walking through the book area, and this man sitting alone and behind a book desk said, "Hey, who are you?" And I told him, and he said, "You got any book ideas?" And I said, "Yeah, I have one. I want to write a book on the positive aspects of bureaucracy." And he said, "Oh, you mean the case for bureaucracy?" And I said, "Well, you could call it that. I didn't plan to call it that, but he did that." And so he became my editor for this book. And it started on the first edition about 2 years later, or a year and a half. And then it went for four editions. And then the most recent one is The New Case for Bureaucracy. So that's how I got stuck with a reputation of being the polemicist for bureaucracy, but I didn't mind that at all.
Well, I think that's actually kind of a neat way to have the title emerge.
Yeah, I enjoy doing things that are different than what everybody else thinks, or in different ways of looking at things. I kind of like doing that.
Well, I think the case for bureaucracy has certainly done that over the years. It's definitely had a fairly lasting reputation, because one of the things that everybody likes to do is, of course, criticize the job that government does, but that just because people criticize it doesn't mean it's actually doing a bad job of it.
Absolutely. And, you know, you think of the field of business administration. Do you think those students are taught and then walk out lambasting the way businesses are run? No. They believe in the work of business managers. But in Puerto Rico, in public administration, I found that there was an automatic suspicion about the efficacy and professionalism and even reliability in terms of carrying out public policy in public administration. So I set out to change that, and I hope I had that effect. You know, I'm so pleased, Bruce, during these hearings and right now going on about how the press has noticed these civil servants and public servants and diplomats coming in to testify are such stalwart people and so straightforward and decent and informed and impartial. They keep saying that over and over, like nobody thought of that before.
Yeah. I think it does surprise a lot of people, or at least nowadays, because everybody assumes if you're working for government, you're highly politicized. But yep. As one of the people said, you know, their job is not to work with the party. Their job is kind of to work for the country.
Exactly. That sums it right up right there. And I think our own internal professorate has accepted that, but the outside public has not necessarily. Well, informed people, yes, but uninformed people still are very suspicious. I suppose that's automatic when you have a democracy that has free speech.
Since you came out with the first edition of the book in the early 80s, have you seen there be kind of any movement in terms of moving away from a relatively efficient government to something else? Or do you kind of see us still being in that same efficient and effective light?
I think the approval polls have stayed about the same. But when I came around to write that last edition that the publisher wanted me to do, I felt different about the whole subject. I think I had gone through an inside change in my emotions on the subject. I no longer felt like I had to go to the battle lines and yell and push and cherry pick data and all that, be a polemicist, but I wanted to have it a quiet essay on the subject. And so it has a very different tone, that last one. That's why I had the editor change the title. But we still have that problem. We always will. You know, I suppose that we would worry if people started accepting everything that government did as automatically good. That would be just as bad.
It would put us out of jobs, I suppose, as public administrators.
Yeah, that's true, too.
I think part of what kind of intrigues me about this conversation is about 2 weeks ago, we recorded with Don Moynihan and Pam Hurd, who had a recent book come out talking about the administrative burden, which really kind of focuses on the sometimes intended, sometimes unintended burden that you get placed upon you by having to work within the political or the bureaucratic system when you need to have things accomplished.
Well, institutions exist to provide a framework of law and guidance, and if they make life more uncomfortable for us, so much so. I'm trying to get one of these new driver's licenses now we need in Virginia. It's the Real ID. You probably are doing that in North Carolina, too.
I have my appointment set up for early December to get mine done.
Well, I decided to go down to our DMV and do it. And so I got together all the stuff, and my passports had all expired. So I had to have my birth certificate. And so I went into the deposit vault in my bank and pulled out a certificate that said the birth of Charles Goodsell and so on and so on. And I took it in, and they looked at it, and they said, he said, this is a hospital document. This is not a state document. this point about bureaucracy. And they said, you have to get your real state document. And so I went back to the deposit box and rustled through it, and I found another document. It was from the state of Michigan, the official document, and it says a birth registration certificate. So I said, that's what I need. So I went back there and showed it to them, and they looked at it and said, Mr. Goodsell, that is not a birth certificate. That's a registration certificate. And they said, you got to get the birth certificate. So what they did, they gave me a list of phone numbers to call. And so I went home and called them and talked to the people in Lansing. And they said, okay, we'll get you one just in a few days and send in a fee. So you know, bureaucracy has its point. It's got rules it has to accept, many of which are set in statute. And they can't go about bypassing the rules unless it's something really essential, absolutely essential.
What I kind of found entertaining, because you and I had originally scheduled for last week, and when we were talking about rescheduling and you said that you had missed because you were at the DMV, first thing I did was start laughing, because when everybody talks about inefficient government, almost everybody talks about that being the DMV, which in the context of your book kind of made me chuckle a little bit.
Uh-huh. Well, some DMVs are very crowded, and ours is pretty heavily used, but they have some excellent systems here to keep people moving through, and they have enough clerks. In fact, there was a Republican governor a few years ago who had a man come in to improve the DMVs of the state, and he did a beautiful job. You know, I hate to admit that a Republican could do a good job, but he did a wonderful job. So a bureaucracy can improve. And the thing we have to do is accept the need to keep it constantly improving. It's never acceptable in a sense of perfect. And things change, and it must also be constantly improved. And I have you might call it a rhetorical difference with most people in the field of our dear subject, and that is, it's constantly saying we have to have reform the federal personnel system, reform this and reform that, and you know, I tell them that what we have to do is proceed from what's been done and make that better, improve, don't reform it.
Right.
If you walked home and told your wife, I think our marriage should be reformed, she's going to kick you out of the house. You say, let's talk about how making things better.
Out of curiosity, in terms of thinking about your own experience and the discussion and work about bureaucracy that you've done for new academics or for PhD students or even MPA students, how do you kind of see their capacity or their options, or what advice would you give them to kind of go off and think about how to revise and improve upon what government actually does? I know that's a large question. I'm not sure I worded it very good, but
yeah. Well, I'll explore a few ideas with you. The new professors, I tell them that if they're in a college, good teaching will make it for you. Really good teaching. But if you're in a university, you're going to have to publish, and you might as well accept that and just put that in your time schedule to do that and do a good job, especially after you've gotten your feet wet. And and so you're going to need to keep looking for things to write about and look for things that interest you. And don't be afraid to part ways with what other scholars have said before you, the field of knowledge in a social science is not, it's not accumulative, it's additive. It keeps on growing, not necessarily getting closer to the truth, but finding different truths, you might say. So that's one thing I do. And in the field of public administration, I try to point out that it's really a fascinating field. It's the heart of governance, as Frederick Friedrich called it. It's the heart of modern governance, and crucial, absolutely crucial to democracy, if you believe in democracy. One of the first things you have to do is accept the importance of administration, because if administration doesn't work, any democratically selected government, it's going to fall eventually. And so I try to put in there a concept of the field has an inherent responsibility for integrity and living up to its assignments. And so it's a field of moral importance, in my view, moral importance as well as practical importance. And I try to instill people in thinking that way if they are amenable to it. And I like them to explore the literatures widely, and so they can really taste what's out there and what gaps there might be that you could try to fill somehow or add to. I urge them to do practical things like anytime you got an idea, get a file folder and write a note and put it in there. And keep it, and just keep that file of ideas available, so if later on you're looking for something, you can go back to how you thought before. And I also suggest that they use the dissertation as a springboard rather than as the final achievement of a capstone of their career. It's just a springboard. And get it done, do it well, get your degree, but then you can look around. You're free to look around and try other things and publish not only book length but also articles. And when you do the latter, look for publishers that carry the kind of article you want to write, so you can have it reviewed by sympathetic ears, a sympathetic view in that kind of subject matter or methodology. And another one of my things I harp on is, speaking of methodology, the pendulum always is swinging between quantitative and qualitative, and at any given moment that's going to be still in motion, but there's room for every conceivable kind of methodology to be done and done well. Like for instance, I got interested in unobtrusive observation and did two or three things in that realm, and it was really fun to do. So those are some of the things I try to get across.
You know, one thing you had mentioned was, focus on research that interests you. I know you've done some stuff since you've retired, but are there kind of lingering questions that still interest you that you haven't had the time or necessarily the energy to get out and do, but still questions that you think are important that need to be addressed?
Yeah, I've kept writing since I retired in 2002 and going full blast. And one thing I did was to finish that fifth edition for The Case for Bureaucracy. And then I got interested in the thought of writing some articles that I thought would point out how we are, as a discipline, we are beholden to sociology and psychology and political science and economics we have our own, we have now our own mature collection of ideas and methods and questions that we can stand on our own 2 feet, and we don't have to constantly depend on these other disciplines to be respectable. So I did that, and then I got a crazy idea that I have been doing qualitative work on various institutional subjects. Like I wrote a book on outstanding agencies that I ran into, and it's called Mission Mystique. And in that case, the unit of analysis was the organization, the institution. And then I thought, well, you know, what if I turned to a even more final unit of analysis, ultimate unit of analysis, that of the individual bureaucrat, and did a study of not six agencies, but six outstanding agencies, but 12 outstanding bureaucrats. And so I worked on that for a long time and got that done. And at the suggestion of a friend of mine, I wrote not only essays on each person, but I interviewed them on video and had the videos put into the book as being available through a website that was created. And that kind of destroyed in my mind the whole concept of stereotyping bureaucrats and bureaucracy, you know, like the concept of public service motivation. And you know, they have four variables on that, and you know, like close to 100 articles have been written in that method, and you know, you really can't stereotype these people. They are human beings, and all kinds of human beings, and all kinds of backgrounds and motivations, and all kinds of work, everything from A to Z. And so, I almost felt like I was discovering a new subject matter called public administration. It was a new reality to me, is this group of 12 men and women, each laboring in a different policy area, a different work, but all of them doing their darndest. And the one thing that they had in common, that they were constantly trying to improve what was going on. So that, and then since that, I've done two projects. I got one underway now. The one that's finished, I became extremely disturbed by the Trump administration and decided to keep track of everything he did with respect to his dealings with bureaucracy and the administrative people. And I started building an archive the day he was inaugurated from articles in the Washington Post, and kept it up until a few months ago. And so I had this huge file of stuff, and I made the material in the file retrievable. I worked out a system of retrieval, and I wrote an article on that, and called it the anti-public administration presidency. The damage that Trump has wrought. And I published that in ARPA. And that has been noticed, I tell you, in different places, including in the bureaucracy itself. And that really was satisfying to me, to blow the whistle on this guy personally. So that got that out of my system. Now I'm doing something really, really different. I found in an antique store a great big book, an inch thick, the program document for the 1936 Democratic Convention in Philadelphia in July of 1936. And in it, I found that all of the major administrators, Harold Ion Ickes and Harry Hopkins and everybody else, had been told to write an article describing what they had done since 1933, March 4th, 1933, up to the present, and that would be the late, mid 1936. And it's been a treasure trove, Bruce, of detailed description of the formation of ideas and the complications of carrying out all of the ideas of the early New Deal. The spread, the scope of their actions is just breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. And so I'm describing all of that, and I'm gonna call it the early New Deal bureaucracy: an inspiration for tomorrow? In other words, the spirit and forcefulness and creativity and imagination of these men and women, including Frances Perkins, she was one of them, a woman at that time, in dealing with all of these social and economic problems that was, or in the Great Depression that caused by it, how they attacked all of this stuff, is to me an inspiration for what we can do after Trump, and especially if we get Democratic control of the Senate and get a good new president and start over again, building a great America, and not that there would be exact items to copy them in any sense, but the ideas and the sense of purpose and the degree of toleration of experimentation and exploratory work in new ways of doing things without many limits almost on what you can do. It was an explosion of innovation that 3 years, absolutely, from the public administration standpoint. So just from the history standpoint, I think it's worth having in our field available for new people coming in. But you know, the policymakers and politicians might even take inspiration from that. So I'm over halfway done with it.
I think there's a couple things about that that's interesting. One, I think, you know, nowadays people don't necessarily know what all of government actually does. They know that government's out there doing things, but they don't necessarily see all that. And so having some kind of list or reporting of what people have to say, that here's what I've done the last couple of years, I think people can relate to that.
Yeah, people just skip over the details when they survey the course of history and their read on what's going on in public affairs. Most of the attention is on the headlines and on the big political blow-ups and elections and passages of statutes. You know, that's just the beginning of what goes on in governance. So, the realities are, you know, many, many inches below that. all of the detail has to be cared for, and building institutions and motivating them and hiring people, instilling the right values. You know, the public administration is the heart of modern governance, and it's the biggest part. That's the other thing. We shouldn't be hesitant to say that to our young people coming in. It's the biggest single part of democratic governance is administration. When you you count all of the decisions have to be made and the dollars that have to be spent and the people we have to hire. So I like to be a preacher. One of my wonderful teachers at Harvard was John Gauss, G-A-U-S, John Gauss. Some pronounce it Gauss. I pronounced it Gauss. And he was at the end of his, late in his career when I knew him, and he was such an inspiration to me. You know, he sort of preached the gospel almost. So I got really my normative brain cells going there.
The last kind of question I had kind of relates back to a few things that we were talking about earlier, you know, thinking about the idea or kind of what public administration is. And that question kind of relates back to the Blacksburg Manifesto, which has really kind of created or become the centerpiece of what public administration is and how we actually view it.
Our program was surprisingly successful. Gary Walmsley, you heard his name, I'm sure. He was the founder of this PhD program that started up. And I was the first one he hired to be on the regular faculty. And we created a group of about 8 or 9 people that really got together and I think made one of the best, not the best, but made one of the best PhD programs at the time. I'll tell you something just as a footnote. When I was still in Carbondale, I was asked to come to Raleigh to interview for chairman of your department of public administration.
You should have come.
Yeah, but they didn't choose me. I probably would have accepted it. I like the university and the city a lot, and the people that I was able to meet, but they didn't ask me. So I'm glad they didn't, because I would have interrupted my writing because of the job. In fact, a general characteristic of my career is that the things I didn't get but tried to were the luckiest steps that I made.
I like it.
And that's really an odd kind of illogical idea, but it is.
I think things turn out precisely how they're supposed to, whether we understand it or see it at the time.
We have to not just plan things in our lives. We have to take advantage of what happens and be open to opportunities and take risks. That's my idea.
I think that's a great place to stop. So I would like to thank you for coming on the show with me today.
Well, I enjoy talking to you.